A red letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors. Light glistens along a green, then red paintbrush stroke. The brush stroke tapers off into flying geese that change from red to orange to yellow. Text appears underneath, Indian paintbrush. A title appears in handwritten font, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar by Roald Dahl. Throughout, the set changes like in a play. Characters act parts out or narrate to us, sometimes appearing as another character. Soft sunshine filters into a hut with a cluttered table.
Well, here we are now in the hut where I write. I've been in this hut for 30 years now. Well, it's important. Before I start, I like to make sure I have everything around me that I'm going to need. Cigarettes, of course, some coffee, chocolates.
A light-skinned man with receding gray hair sits.
And always make sure I have a sharp pencil before I start. I have 6 pencils, and then I like to clean my writing board. So many bits of rubber. There.
The gray-haired man wipes off a board over his lap.
And then finally one starts.
Roald Dahl, the gray-haired man, writes on a large notepad.
And so, usually a few corrections needed.
He wears glasses and a cardigan over his red outfit.
Yeah. And
Roald looks at us, then places his notepad on a desk.
Henry Sugar was 41 years old, unmarried and rich. He was rich because he had a rich father who was now dead. He was unmarried because he was too selfish to share any of his money with a wife. He was 6 feet 2 inches tall and not perhaps as handsome as he thought he was. He paid a great deal of attention to his clothes. He went to an expensive tailor for his suits, to a shirtmaker for his shirts, and to a bootmaker for his shoes. His hairdresser trimmed his hair once every 10 days, and he always took a manicure at the same time. He drove a Ferrari motor car, which cost him about the same as a country cottage.
He sets aside the board.
All his friends were rich, and he had never done a day's work in his life. Men like Henry Sugar can be found drifting like seaweed all over the world. They're not particularly bad men, but they're not good men either.
He unwraps a candy.
They're simply part of the decoration.
He pops it in his mouth, then steps outside.
All rich people of Henry's type, of course, have one peculiarity in common, a terrific urge to make themselves richer. The 10 million is never enough, nor is 20 million. Always they suffer the insatiable longing for more money and the terror of waking up one morning and finding nothing in the bank. These people employ various methods to increase their fortunes. Some buy stocks and shares and watch them go up and down. Some buy land or art or diamonds. Some bet on roulette, blackjack, horses. Some indeed bet on anything. Henry Sugar was one of those, and not at all above cheating, by the way.
A gate reads Gypsy House.
One summer weekend, Henry drove down from London to the countryside to stay with Sir William W. The house was magnificent, so were the grounds. But when Henry arrived that Saturday, it was already pelting with rain. The host and his other guests whiled away the afternoon playing games, while Henry glumly stared out at the drops splashing against the windows.
Henry wandered out of the drawing room and into the front hall.
Roald looks through a window.
He drifted through the house, aimless. Then finally, mooched into the library.
In a library, Henry, a dark-haired, light-skinned man, enters.
Sir William's father had been an important book collector, and all 4 walls of this huge room were lined with beautiful, antiquated, leather-bound volumes, floor to ceiling. Henry Sugar wasn't interested. The only books he read were detective novels and thrillers. Nothing like that here. He was about to leave when his eye was caught and held by something quite different. It was so slim he never would have noticed it if it hadn't been sticking out a little from the books on either side. He pulled it from the shelf. It was actually nothing more than a cardboard exercise book of the kind that children use at school. The cover was dark blue, but there was nothing written on it. On the first page, hand-printed in black ink, clear and neat, it said,
A report on Imdad Khan, The Man Who Sees Without Eyes, by Dr. Z.Z. Chatterjee.
Weird. What is this? He settled himself into an armchair and started from the beginning.
He stares at us.
The following is what Henry read in the little blue exercise book.
In a hospital room with doctors, Chatterjee, a russet-skinned male doctor with a thin mustache, looks at us.
My name is Z.Z. Chatterjee, head surgeon at Lords and Ladies Hospital, Calcutta. On the morning of the 2nd of December, 1935, I was in the doctor's restroom having a cup of tea. 3 other doctors were present with me. Dr. Marshall, Dr. Mithra, and Dr. McFarlane. There was a knock on the door. Come in, I said.
An amber-skinned man with a thick white mustache enters.
Excuse me, please. May I ask you gentlemen a favor?
This is a private room, I said.
Yes, I know, and I'm very sorry to burst in like this, but I have a most, I think, interesting thing to show you.
All 4 of us were pretty annoyed and we didn't say anything.
Gentlemen, I am a man who can see without using his eyes.
The doctors stare.
He was a small man, about 60, with a white moustache and a curious matting of black hair growing all over the outsides of his ears.
You may bandage my head with 50 bandages in any way you wish, and I will still be able to read you a book.
He seemed perfectly serious. I felt my curiosity beginning to stir. Come in, please.
Imdad, the man with the thick moustache, approaches Chatterjee and Dr. Marshall, a curly-haired, tawny-skinned man. Chatterjee covers Imdad's eyes.
All right. How many fingers is Dr. Marshall holding up?
7.
Once more, I said.
9.
Once more, I said.
3.
Once more, I said.
3 again.
Once more.
Marshall makes fists.
No fingers.
Marshall glances at us.
Oh. What's the trick?
There's no trick.
This is a genuine thing I've managed after years of training.
What sort of training?
Forgive me, sir, but that is a private matter.
The three look at us.
What can we do for you?
I work in a travelling theatre. We arrived in Calcutta today. Tonight we give our opening performance at the Royal Palace Hall. I am billed on the programme as Imdad Khan, the man who sees without his eyes. Whenever our company arrives in a new town, I go straight to the largest hospital and ask the doctors to bandage my eyes in the most thorough and expert fashion. It is important this job is done by doctors, otherwise people may think I'm cheating. Then I go out into the streets and do a dangerous thing.
I looked at the other three doctors. Dr. Mitra and Dr. McFarlane had to go back to their patients. Go on. But Dr. Marshall said...
Why not? Let's do the job properly, though. Let's make absolutely certain you can't see anything.
You are extremely kind. Please do whatever you wish.
Before we bandage him, I said to Dr. Marshall, let's fill his eye sockets with something soft and solid.
Dough.
Perfect. You nip down to the hospital bakery while I take him into the surgery and seal his eyelids. I led Imdad Khan down the long hospital corridor to the surgery. Lie down there, please, I said. I took a small bottle of collodion from the cupboard. I'm going to glue your eyelids shut with this stuff.
How do I remove it later?
Just dab a bit of alcohol carefully below the lashes. That'll dissolve it. Keep your eyes closed while we wait for it to harden, please. 2 minutes passed. Try to open your eyes, I said. Of course, he couldn't. I took a lump of Dr. Marshall's dough and plastered it over one of Imdad Khan's eyes. I filled the whole socket and let the dough overlap onto the surrounding skin. I did the same with the other eye. I pressed the edges down hard. That isn't too uncomfortable, is it? I asked.
Not at all, thank you.
You do the bandaging, I said to Dr. Marshall. My fingers are too sticky.
Pleasure. I'll just pop these here.
Dr. Marshall laid a thick wad of cotton wool on top of Imdad Khan's dough-filled eyes. It stuck in place.
Sit up, please.
Imdad sits up.
Dr. Marshall wrapped a roll of 3-inch bandage round and round the man's face and head.
Please, do leave my nose free for breathing.
Of course. Sorry, it's going to be a pinch on the tight side.
They fasten a pre-wrapped bandage around Imdad's head.
How's that?
Splendid, I said. He looked like a man who had suffered some terrible brain operation.
How does it feel?
It feels very good. I must compliment you, gentlemen, on doing such a thorough job.
Imdad Khan stood up off the bed and walked straight to the door.
Crew roll away privacy curtains and a hospital bed, revealing the hospital room again. Chatterjee and Marshall watch as Imdad leaves.
Great Scott! Did you see that? He put his hand right on the doorknob. Dr. Marshall, stop grinning.
In a hallway.
Imdad Khan was walking normally quite briskly along the hospital corridor. Dr. Marshall and I followed 5 yards behind him. And very spooky it was to watch this man with an enormous white and totally bandaged head strolling casually along the corridor. He saw it, I cried. He saw that trolley. This is absolutely unbelievable.
They dodge a trolley.
Dr. Marshall didn't answer. His whole face was rigid with shocked disbelief.
Marshall looks at us.
Imdad Khan came to the stairs and went down with no trouble at all. He didn't even put a hand on the stair rail. Several people were coming up. You can see how they reacted.
Nurses move out of the way.
At the bottom of the stairs, he turned and headed out the doors of the street.
Chatterjee returns to look at us.
Dr. Marshall and I kept close behind him.
Outside.
Below us in the courtyard, a waiting crowd of 100 barefoot children shouted and surged towards our white-headed visitor. He greeted them by holding both hands above his head. He walked directly to a bicycle, mounted it, and pedaled the figure eights around the courtyard. The barefoot children chased him, cheering and laughing in his wake. He sped straight out into the chaotically bustling traffic of the busy street with honking, careening motor cars whizzing around him in every direction. He rode superbly. For a minute, we kept him in sight. Then he turned a corner and was gone. I can't bring myself to believe it, Dr. Marshall said.
I can't bring myself to believe it.
I can't either, I said. I think we just witnessed a miracle.
Marshall heads in.
The rest of the day, I was kept busy with patients in the hospital. At 6 in the evening, I drove back to my flat for a change of clothes. I took a long, cool shower. I drank a whiskey and soda sitting on the veranda with only a towel around my waist. At 7:10, I arrived at the Royal Palace Hall.
At a show.
The show lasted 2 hours. To my surprise, I enjoyed it. The juggler, the snake charmer, the fire eater, the sword swallower pushed a rapier 4 feet down his throat and into his stomach. Last of all, to a great fanfare of trumpets, our friend Imdad Khan came out to do his act. Members of the audience were called on stage to blindfold him with sheets and scarves before he threw knives all around a small boy's body and shot a tin can off the small boy's head with a revolver.
A man puts a barrel over Chatterjee.
A metal barrel was fitted over his already bandaged head. The boy placed a needle in one of Imdad Khan's hands and a length of cotton thread in the other. An enormous magnifying glass was positioned in front of him, and, with no false moves, he neatly threaded the thread through the eye of the needle.
Behind a magnifying glass, Chatterjee mimes threading a needle. The man takes the barrel off.
I was flabbergasted.
Backstage, Chatterjee addresses us.
Backstage, I found Imdad Khan sitting quietly on a wooden stool while he removed his stage makeup.
You're curious, Doctor, am I correct?
Most curious, I said. Once again, I was struck by the peculiarly thick matting of black hair growing on the outsides of his ears. I'd never seen anything quite like it on any other person. I have a proposal. I'm not a writer by profession, but if you'll tell me exactly how you developed this power of being able to see without your eyes, I'll take it down as faithfully as I can, then I'll type it up and try to get it published in the British Medical Journal, or maybe even in some famous magazine. Would that help you to become better known?
It would help me very much.
Splendid. I have a sort of private shorthand I use for taking down medical histories. I believe I got everything Imdad Khan said to me that evening, word for word. I give it to you now, exactly as you spoke it.
Imdad stands under scrawled text that reads, "Everything Imdad Khan said to me that evening, word for word." A model train passes.
I was born in Kashmir State in 1873. My father was a ticket inspector on the National Railway. One day, a conjurer came to our school and gave a performance. I was spellbound. 2 weeks later, I took all my savings and ran away from home to join a traveling theater company. That was in 1886. I was 13 years old. For 3 years, I traveled with this group all over the Punjab. By the end of it, I was playing top of the bill. All the time, I was saving money, which finally added up to just over 3,000 rupees. At this moment, I heard tell of a great famous yogi who had acquired the rare power of levitation. It was said that when he prayed, his whole body left the ground and rose up 18 inches into the air. At the very least, a terrific effect. Moustache?
Imdad, now grey-haired, exits.
I quit the theatre company and made my way to the small town on the banks of the Ganges, where rumour said this yogi was living. One day, I overheard a traveller mention a hermit he had encountered not so very far away in the densest jungle, all alone.
Henry, as a traveller, enters and exits.
I dashed out to hire a horse and cart. As I negotiated with the driver, a man appeared and said he was going in the same direction and suggested we share the ride and split the cost.
A man in a turban nears.
What truly fantastic luck. Talking to my companion, I found that he was the disciple of the great yogi himself and on his way at that very moment to visit his master. I blurted out, "This is the man I'm looking for. Please, may I meet him?"
Night falls.
My companion looked at me long and slow. "That is impossible," he said. From this point forward, he refused to answer my questions. However, I managed to learn one small thing. The time of day, the great yogi commenced his meditation. My companion signaled to halt the cart, dismounted, and was gone. I pretended to drive on, but just around the corner, I jumped down and snuck back along the path. Already, the man had disappeared into the jungle. I heard a rustling in the undergrowth. If that's not him, I thought, then it's a tiger, and I'm about to be pounced upon, thoroughly thrashed, and eaten in little torn morsels of bloody flesh.
A jungle background appears.
It was him.
Imdad glances back, then exits.
There was not even a shadow of a trace of a path where the man was walking. He was pushing his way between tall bamboos and every kind of heavy vegetation. I crept after him, very quiet, keeping at least 100 yards behind. Whenever I lost sight of him, which was most of the time, I was able to follow the sound of his footsteps. For half an hour, this tense game of follow the leader went on. Then, suddenly, I no longer heard the man in front of me. I stopped and listened. All at once, through the thick undergrowth, I saw a little clearing and two small huts. My heart jumped. There was a small waterhole next to the nearest hut with a prayer mat beside it, and above, a large baobab tree with beautiful, thick, leafy branches.
Imdad enters.
All through the great noontime heat, I waited. On through the heavy, wet heat of the afternoon, I waited. Then, as 5 o'clock approached, I quietly climbed up my tree and hid among the leaves. Finally, the great yogi came out of his hut and sat cross-legged on the mat. Each movement he made was calm and gentle. He put his hands palm downward on his knees and took a long breath through his nostrils. And already I could see a sort of brightness was melting over him. For 14 minutes, he remained perfectly still in this position.
A yogi sits on a painted box.
As I watched, I saw, quite positively, his body slowly lifting off the ground.
It blends with the background.
12 inches, 15, 18, 20. 2 feet above the prayer mat. Up in the tree, I said to myself, there before you is a man sitting in the air.
The yogi dismounts.
46 minutes by my watch, his body remained suspended, and then he slowly descended back to earth until his buttocks rested again upon the mat. I climbed down from my tree and ran straight over. The great yogi was washing his hands and feet in a basin. "How long have you been here?" he said sharply. Suddenly, he picked up a brick and threw it at me so hard it broke in two as it struck my right leg just below the knee. I have the scar still. I'll show it to you.
The yogi lifts a stone and points at Imdad's scarred leg.
This was actually a stroke of luck. A great yogi isn't meant to lose his temper and fling bricks. The old man was humiliated, remorseful, and deeply disappointed in himself. He explained to me that though he could not take me on as a disciple, he would, nevertheless, give me some informal instruction in order to make amends for attacking me, an attack I fully deserved, by the way. This was in 1890. I was nearly 17 years old.
In a stone hut, light shines on Imdad.
Now, what was the great yogi's instruction? Here it comes.
The mind is a scattered thing. It concerns itself with thousands of different items at once. Things you are seeing around you, things you are hearing and smelling, things you are thinking about, things you are trying not to think about. You must learn to concentrate your mind in such a way that you can visualize at will one item only, and absolutely nothing else. If you work hard at this, you may be able to concentrate your conscious mind on any one object you select for approximately 3.5 minutes. This will take around 20 years of diligent daily continual effort.
20 years, I cried.
20 years. It may take longer. 20 years is the usual time, if you're able to do it at all, by the way.
I'll be an old man by then.
The time varies. Some take 10 years, some take 30. On extremely rare occasions, a special person comes along who's able to develop the power in only 1 or 2 years, but this is one in a billion, not you.
Is it really that difficult to concentrate the mind for just...
Almost impossible. Try it and see. Shut your eyes and think of something. Think of just one object. Visualize it. See it before you. In a few seconds, your mind will start to wander. Other thoughts will creep in. It's a very difficult thing. Thus spoke the great wise old yogi.
Imdad turns to us. The light dims.
And so, my exercises began.
Outside the stone hut.
Each evening I sat down, closed my eyes, and visualized the person I loved best in the world, which was my elder brother, who died aged 10 from a blood disease. I concentrated on picturing his face, but the instant my mind began to wander, I stopped the exercise, rested for several minutes, then I tried again. After 5 years of daily practice, I was able to concentrate absolutely on my brother's face for 1.5 minutes. I was making progress.
On a patio with a city background, Imdad sits at a table.
In the meantime, I began to earn quite good money giving conjuring performances. By nature, my sleight of hand is very good, but always I continued my exercises. Every evening, wherever I was, I settled myself down in a quiet spot and concentrated my mind on my brother's face. Sometimes I lit a candle and began by staring at the flame. A candle flame, as you know, has three separate parts, the yellow at the top, the mauve lower down, and the black inside. I placed the candle 16 inches away from my face, absolutely level with my eyes, so I did not have to make even the tiniest adjustment of my eye muscles by looking up or down. I stared at the black part right in the center until everything around me disappeared. Then I shut my eyes and began to concentrate on my brother's face.
He gets a coffee cup.
By 1907, when I was 34 years old, I could concentrate for 3 minutes without any wandering of my mind whatsoever. It was also at this time that I began to become aware of a slight ability. Just a queer little feeling that when I closed my eyes and looked at something hard with fierce intensity, I could see the outline of the object I was looking at. I thought of a thing the old yogi had said to me. Certain holy people have been known to develop so great a concentration they can see without using their eyes.
Crew bring props.
Each night, after I performed my exercises with a candle flame, I drank a cup of coffee, then I blindfolded myself and sat in my chair, trying to see without my eyes. I started with a deck of playing cards. I studied the backs. I guessed the values immediately. I had a 60% success rate. Later, I bought maps and navigational charts and pinned them up all around my room. I spent hours looking at them blindfolded, trying to read the small lettering of the place names and the rivers. Every evening for the next 8 years, I proceeded with this kind of practice. By 1915, I could read a book straight through, cover to cover, blindfolded. I had it. At last, I had this power.
Chatterjee enters.
Of course, as you know, it became my entire conjuring performance. Audiences loved it, but no one ever believed it to be genuine. Still don't. Even doctors, such as yourself, who blindfold me in the most expert fashion, refuse to believe anyone can see without his eyes. They forget that there are other ways of sending an image to the brain.
Imdad Khan fell silent. He was tired. What other ways, I asked.
Imdad exhales.
Quite honestly, I do not know. The seeing is done by another part of the body.
Which part?
Imdad stares at a candle's flame in front of him, then stands. Imdad enters a room and lies on a bed. Chatterjee sits at the table.
That night, I didn't go to bed. This man would have scientists all over the world turning somersaults in the air. He must be the most valuable man alive. I had to find out exactly how it was, biologically, chemically, magically, that an image could be sent to the brain without using the eyes. Blind people might be able to see. Deaf people to hear, who knows what else. This incredible man must not be ignored, I thought. I started transcribing with great care everything Imdad Khan had told me that evening. I wrote for 5 hours without stopping.
In the hospital room, Chatterjee and Marshall sit.
At 8 o'clock the next morning, time to go to the hospital, I finished the most important part, the pages you have just read. I didn't see Dr. Marshall until we met in the doctor's restroom for our tea break. I told him as much as I could in the 10 minutes we had to spare. I'm going back to the theatre tonight, I said. We can't lose him now.
I'll come with you.
At 6:45 that evening, we drove to the Royal Palace Hall. I parked the car and the two of us walked to the theatre.
They stand.
There's something wrong, I said. There was no crowd outside the hall and the doors were closed. The poster advertising the show was still in place, but I now saw that someone had printed across it in black paint.
Tonight's performance cancelled.
I asked an old gatekeeper standing by the locked doors. What happened?
Someone died.
Who? Of course, I already knew.
The man who sees without his eyes.
How? I cried.
He went to sleep and never woke up. These things happen.
Chatterjee joins Marshall in staring at us.
We walk slowly back to the car.
Chatterjee steps back and sits.
I felt an overwhelming sense of grief and anger. I should never have allowed this precious man out of my sight. I should have given him my bed and taken care of him. Imdad Khan was a maker of miracles. He had communicated with mysterious and powerful forces far beyond the reach of ordinary people. Now he was dead. That's that, Dr. Marshall said.
That's that?
Yes, I said. That's that.
Marshall sits with Chatterjee.
This is a true and accurate report of everything that took place concerning my two meetings with Imdad Khan.
In the library, Henry reads the end of an exercise book.
Well, well, well. Now that is extremely interesting.
Henry looks at us.
This is a terrific piece of information. This could change my life.
Henry shuts the book and heads to the exit. He stops at the door, casts a furtive glance, then hides the book under his suit jacket. He leaves. In the gypsy house, Roald lights a cigarette with a match. He shakes the flame out. He blows out smoke as he sets the used match on the desk.
The piece of information Henry was referring to was that Imdad Khan had trained himself to read the value of a playing card from the reverse side. And being, as mentioned, a dishonest gambler, Henry realized at once he could make a fortune. He went downstairs to the butler's pantry and asked for a candle, a candlestick, and a ruler. He took them to his bedroom, locked the door, drew the curtains, and turned off the lights. He put the candle on the dressing table and pulled up a chair. He noticed with satisfaction that his eyes were exactly level with the wick. Using the ruler, he positioned his face 16 inches from the candle, as indicated in the book. Imdad Khan had visualized the face of the person he loved best, which in his case was his deceased brother. Henry didn't have a brother. He decided instead to visualize his own face.
Roald holds up a portrait of Henry. A projected background video of a moving road plays. Henry pretends to drive a car.
As Henry stared into the tiny black area at the center of the candle flame, an extraordinary thing happened. His mind went absolutely blank, his brain ceased fidgeting, and all at once, he felt as if his entire body had become encased snug and cozy within that little black area of burning nothingness. Admittedly, this lasted only 15 seconds. But from that moment on, no matter where he was or what he was doing, he made a point of practicing with the candle 5 times a day.
1 month later.
For the first time in his life, he threw himself into something with genuine enthusiasm, and the progress he made was remarkable.
After 6 months, he could concentrate absolutely upon the image of his own face for no less than 3 minutes without a single outside thought entering his mind.
In different rooms.
It's me, Henry thought. I'm the one in a billion gifted with the ability to acquire yoga powers at incredible speed.
By the end of the first year, he'd exceeded 5.5 minutes.
Henry blows out a candle.
The time had come.
September 16th, 1959. In a swanky flat, Henry enters.
The living room of Henry's London flat, midnight. Henry shakes with excitement as for the first time he places a deck of cards upside down before him and concentrates on the top card. All he can see initially is the very ordinary design of thin red lines on the back, perhaps the most common playing card design in the world. He now shifts his concentration from the pattern itself to the other side of the card. He focuses with great intensity upon the invisible underneath of the card. 30 seconds elapse. 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Henry doesn't move a muscle. His now highly developed concentration is absolute. He visualizes the reverse of the playing card. No other thought of any kind is permitted to enter his mind. During the 4th minute, something starts to happen. Slowly, magically, but distinctly, a black blob becomes a spade. A twisty squiggle becomes a 5. The 5 of spades. Fingers quivering, he picks up the card and turns it over.
A 5 of spades card.
I've done it, he says.
Henry throws the card.
Henry becomes a fanatic. He never leaves his flat except to buy food and drink.
He scampers off.
All day and often far into the night, he crouches over the cards with the stopwatch beside him, reducing his time second by second. Within a month, he's down to 1.5 minutes. 6 months, 20 seconds. 7 more months, 10 seconds flat. His target is 5. He knows that unless he can read through a card in a maximum of 5 seconds, he won't be able to work the casino successfully. Yet the nearer he gets to his target, the more difficult it becomes to reach it. It takes 4 weeks to get from 10 seconds to 9, 5 more to get from 9 to 8. At this stage, hard work no longer bothers him. Of course, he's able to work for 12 hours straight, no trouble at all. He knows with absolute certainty he'll get there in the end. The last 2 seconds are the hardest, 11 months. But late one Saturday afternoon...
Henry, with a scraggly beard, studies a deck of cards as he holds a stopwatch. He picks up the top card, then checks the stopwatch.
5 seconds. Henry goes straight through the pack, timing himself with every card. 5 seconds. 5 seconds. 5 seconds.
He stares at us.
How long has it taken him to reach this moment? 3 years and 3 months of uninterrupted effort.
A building's door reads, Lord's House.
There were well over 100 legitimate casinos in London. Henry was a member of no less than 10 of them. Lord's House was his favorite.
Inside.
It was the finest in the land, located in a magnificent Georgian mansion.
Good evening, Mr. Sugar,
said the man behind the desk, whose job it was to never forget a face. Henry ascended the marvelous wide staircase and entered the cashier's office. He wrote a check for £10,000. Well-fed women circled the roulette wheel like plump hens around a feeding hopper. Men with crimson faces, cigars between their lips, counted their chips, eyes glittering with greed.
Imdad, as a dealer, stands.
Odd. For the first time in Henry's life, he looked with distaste upon a room full of frankly horrible rich people. Henry searched for a vacant seat directly on the dealer's camera left at any of the blackjack tables. The dealer took Henry's plaque and dropped it into a slot in the table. He was a young-ish man with black eyes and grey skin. He never smiled and only spoke when necessary. He had exceptionally slim hands, and there was arithmetic in his fingers. He picked up a wedge of 25-pound chips and placed them in a pile on the table. He didn't need to count them. Those nimble fingers were never wrong. He slid the pile to Henry. As Henry stacked his chips in front of him, he glanced at the top card in the dealer's shoe. In 5 seconds, he read it as a 10. He pushed out 8 of his chips, £200, the maximum stake allowed for blackjack at Lord's House. He was dealt the 10. For his second card, he got a 9. 19 altogether. On 19, you stick. You sit tight and hope the dealer doesn't get 20 or 21. It's a given. When the dealer came round again to Henry, he said...
19.
And passed on to the next player. Wait, said Henry. The dealer paused and came back to Henry. He raised his eyebrows and looked at him with those cool black eyes.
You wish to draw to 19?
He asked crisply. There were, of course, only 2 ranks in the shoe that wouldn't bust a 19, the ace and the 2. Only an idiot would risk drawing on 19, especially with £200 on the table. The back of the next card to be dealt lay clearly visible. The dealer hadn't touched it. Yes, Henry said. Another card. The dealer shrugged and dealt it. The 2 of clubs landed neatly in front of Henry alongside the 10 and the 9.
21.
The dealer said evenly. His black eyes glanced up again into Henry's face and rested there, silent, watchful, puzzled.
People gather.
Henry had unbalanced him. He'd rarely have ever seen anyone draw a 19. This fellow had drawn a 19 with the calmness and certainty that was quite staggering, and he'd won. Henry caught the look in the dealer's eyes and realized at once he'd made a silly mistake. He'd attracted attention. I beg your pardon.
They leave.
He must never do that again. He must be very careful and even make himself lose occasionally. The game went on. Henry's advantage was so enormous, he had difficulty keeping his winnings down to a reasonable sum. In an hour, he'd won £30,000. There he stopped. Could just as easily have been a million.
Henry trades in chips.
Thank you. Henry was now almost certainly capable of making money faster than any other person in the entire world.
He holds a stack of cash.
Interesting.
In the Lord's House lobby, Henry sits on a bench across from a man behind a desk.
Had this been a made-up story instead of a true one, it would have been necessary at this point to invent some kind of a surprising and exciting end for the thing, something dramatic and unusual. For example, Henry could go home to his flat and start counting his money. While doing this, he might suddenly begin to feel unwell. He has a pain in his chest.
Henry stands.
He decides to go to bed immediately. He takes off his clothes. He walks naked to the cupboard to put on his pajamas. He passes the full-length mirror against the wall. He stops. Automatically, from force of habit, he starts to concentrate. All at once, he sees through his own skin. Like an X-ray, only better, he sees everything. Arteries, veins, the blood pumping through him. Liver, kidneys, intestines. He sees his heart beating.
An X-ray image.
He looks at the point in his chest where the pain is coming from and sees a small dark lump inside the large vein leading into the heart on the right-hand side. A blood clot. At first, the clot appears to be stationary. Then it moves. The movement's very slight, only a millimeter or so. The blood in the vein is pumping up behind the clot and pushing past it, and the clot moves again. It jerks forward about half an inch. Henry watches in terror. He knows a large blood clot which is broken free and is travelling in the vein will ultimately reach the heart. He is about to die. Now, that wouldn't be a bad ending for a work of fiction. This story isn't fiction. This story is fact. The only untrue thing about it is Henry's name, which wasn't Henry Sugar. His name has to be protected. Still must be protected. Apart from that, this is a true story. And because it's a true story, it must have the true ending. Here's what actually happened.
Henry steps outside and hands off the cash.
Henry walked for an hour. The evening was cool and pleasant, the city still wide awake. He could feel the thick bankroll in the inside pocket of his jacket. He patted it gently.
A lot of money for an hour's work.
He walks in place in front of a projected moving street.
Oh, man. He couldn't understand why he felt so little excitement about this tremendous success. This sort of thing had happened to him 3 years ago before he started the yoga business. He'd have gone crazy with excitement. He'd been rushing off to the nearest nightclub to celebrate. But Henry didn't feel excited. He felt sad. Every time he made a bet, he'd been certain to win. There was no thrill, no suspense, no danger. Of course, from now on, he knew that he could travel all around the world making millions, but was it going to be any fun? Another thing, was it not entirely possible the process he'd gone through to acquire yoga powers had completely and utterly changed his entire outlook on life? It was possible. The next morning, Henry woke up late, got out of bed, saw the enormous bundle lying on his dressing table, and didn't want it.
Henry, now in pajamas, glances at a parcel that reads 30,000 pounds. In the day at a balcony, Henry opens a window and steps onto the balcony. He holds the stack of cash. He tosses a note of money over the ledge. It floats down. Henry looks downward.
Good morning, sir. That's for you. It's a present.
What?
Put it in your pocket.
Henry releases another note of money to the street below. He regards the drifting note with a smile.
Keep it!
Henry searches the street, then tosses out more money. He stops and looks down. Henry deliberates, then tosses all the money up and over the ledge. It drifts down. Henry leans over the ledge. Henry climbs inside and opens the front door, rolled as a policeman stands on the other side.
The doorbell rang.
What the devil do you think you're doing?
Good morning, officer. I'm sorry about the crowd. I was just giving away some money.
You're inciting a riot.
Just giving away some money. I do beg your pardon. I won't do it again. They'll soon go away, I'm sure.
The policeman took one hand off his hip and produced a £50 note.
Aha, you got one yourself.
This is evidence. Where'd the money come from?
I won it at blackjack. I had a tremendously lucky night.
Henry gave the name of his club and the policeman wrote it down in the little book.
Check it up. They'll tell you it's true.
The policeman lowered the book. I don't care.
Don't you?
Not at all. Not whatsoever. In fact, I believe your story, but that doesn't excuse what you did, even the tiniest little bit.
I didn't do anything illegal, did I?
Illegal? You're an idiot! If you're lucky enough to win yourself a tremendous big sum of money like that and you want to give it away, you don't throw it out of the window. You give it somewhere it'll do some good. A hospital, for instance, or an orphanage. There's hospitals and orphanages all over the country got hardly enough money to buy the kids a present for Christmas. Then along comes a spoiled idiot like you who's never known for a minute what it's like to be hard up, and you throw the stuff out into the street!
With that, the policeman stomped down the stairs and banged out of the front door. Henry didn't move. The policeman's words and the genuine fury with which he'd spoken them struck hard and deep. He was ashamed. It was an awful feeling.
Henry looks at us, then blinks. Henry's head hangs as he enters his living room. He stares at us.
Then, very suddenly, all at once, Henry felt a powerful electricity tingling through his entire body, and there began to come to him the great and marvelous idea that was to change everything. Henry started pacing up and down, ticking off the points that would make his marvelous idea possible. One, I'm going to win a very large sum of money each and every day of my life from this moment forward.
He wears disguises.
Two, I must never go to the same casino more than once every 6 months.
Three, I must never win too much money in one sitting. £50,000 a night, that's my limit. Four, £50,000 a night for 365 days a year, that's 18.25 million pounds. Five, I'll keep moving. No more than two or three nights at a stretch in any one city. London, Monte Carlo, Cannes, Biarritz, Deauville, Las Vegas, Mexico City, Buenos Aires, Nassau. Six, I'll take the money I make and establish hospitals and orphanages all around the world.
He cross-dresses.
As a dream, that sounds corny and sentimental, but as a reality, and I think I can actually make it work, I don't think it would be corny at all. It would be, I think, wonderfully stupendous.
Seven, I need a partner. Someone who could sit behind a desk and receive all the money, then send it back out to the people who need it. Someone I could deeply, emphatically, categorically trust forever. John Winston was Henry's accountant. He'd also been Henry's father's accountant. And John Winston's father had been Henry's father's accountant.
You could be the richest man on earth.
Chatterjee, as John Winston sits.
I don't want to be the richest man on earth.
Henry nears a window. John exits, then re-enters and sits.
I can't operate in England. The tax man will take it all. I'll have to move to Switzerland, I suppose, but not tomorrow. I'm not an unattached bachelor like you and their responsibilities. I must talk to my wife and children. I must give notice to my partners in the firm. I must sell my house. I must find another house in Switzerland. I must take the kids out of school. These things take time.
1 year later, Henry had sent just over £120 million to John Winston in Lausanne.
The money was delivered 5 days a week to a Swiss company called Winston Sugar LLC. Nobody except John Winston and Henry knew where the money came from or what was going to happen to it. The Monday remittance was always the biggest because it included Henry's take for Friday, Saturday and Sunday when the banks were closed.
He moved with astonishing speed, sometimes changing his identity several times in a single week. Often the only clue John Winston had as to Henry's whereabouts was the address of the bank which had sent the money. It was stupendous.
Henry and John shake hands, then stare at us. Henry meditates on painted boxes that blend in with the places he inhabits. The backstage area, the hospital, and outside the stone hut. Henry opens his eyes.
Henry died last year, age 63, from a pulmonary embolism. He saw it coming, quite literally, but was very much at peace. He'd been following his plan for just over 20 years. He'd made £644 million. He'd left 21 well-established, well-run children's hospitals and orphanages all around the world, administered and financed from Lausanne by John Winston and his staff. His work was complete.
Henry closes his eyes. In the gypsy house, Roald looks at us.
Now, how do I know all this? Good question, I'll tell you. Soon after Henry's death, John Winston telephoned me from Switzerland. He introduced himself simply as the head of a company calling itself Winston Sugar LLC and asked if I'd come to Lausanne to see him with a view to writing a brief history of the organization. I don't know how he chose me. It probably had a list of writers and stuck a pin in it. He would pay me well, he said, and added, "A remarkable man has died recently. His name was Henry Sugar. I think people ought to know a bit about what he has done for the world." In my ignorance, I asked whether the story was really interesting enough to merit being put on paper. This annoyed John Winston very much. Perhaps it even offended him. In 5 minutes on the phone, he told me about Henry Sugar's secret career. It was secret no longer. Henry was dead and would never enter another casino again. "I'm coming," I said.
Outside.
In Lausanne, I met John Winston, now over 70, also Max Engelmann, a renowned makeup artist who traveled the world with Henry, creating fantastic disguises to conceal his identity. They were both shattered by Henry's death, Max even more so than John Winston.
I loved him. He was a great man.
John Winston showed me the original dark blue exercise book written by Z.Z. Chatterjee in Calcutta in 1935. I later copied it out word for word. "One last question," I said. "You keep calling him Henry Sugar, yet you tell me that wasn't his name. Don't you want me to say who he really was when I do the story?"
"No,"
John Winston said.
"Max and I promised never to reveal his identity. Oh, I suppose it'll probably leak out sooner or later. After all, he was from a fairly well-known English family, but I'd appreciate it if you didn't try to find out. Just please, just call him plain Mr. Henry Sugar."
And that is what I have done.
Behind the gate, with the gypsy house in the background, Roald, John, and Henry, as Max, the makeup artist, face us. Cut to black. Text. The wonderful story of Henry Sugar was written by Roald Dahl in his writing hut at Gypsy House in Great Missenden, Buckinghamshire, between February and December of 1976. Opening credits. Netflix and Indian Paintbrush present an American empirical picture. Starring, in order of appearance, Ralph Fiennes, Benedict Cumberbatch, Dev Patel, Ben Kingsley, Richard Ayoade. Written for the screen and directed by Wes Anderson. Audio description provided by International Digital Center. Written by Kathleen Finn and voiced by Kimberly Chatterjee. Credits. Produced by Wes Anderson, Stephen Rails, Jeremy Dawson. Director of Photography, Robert Yeoman, ASC. Production designer, Adam Stockhausen. Costume designer, Kasia Wallika Maimani. Credits continue. Copyright 2023 Netflix. Logo. A red letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors.